Some say industrialization has made food cheap, but others say the nutrients essential to health are disappearing from that food, and so the food is not cheap at all. And so we ask, how cheap is cheap food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Folks, having hosted over 1,200 editions of the Food Chain Radio Show, I have noticed through the years that certain principles hold true. And so, tongue-in-cheek, have claimed them as Michael Olson's three laws of the food chain. Here is Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't. I have noticed over the years that industrialization has made food cheap by taking the nutrients out of it and by subsidizing its true cost of production. Thus, the cheap food promised by industrialization is really the expensive food that we find for sale on the grocer's shelves. There are many who disagree with my third law of the food chain and point to the fact that Americans spend less than 10% of their household income on food, while people in the developing world, without access to industrial foods, spend up to 50% of their household income on food. That is a persuasive argument. To discover the true value of industrial food, we would need to calculate how many of its essential nutrients have disappeared and the extent to which its production has been subsidized. Big job! Fortunately, some of the work is already being done, at least with respect to the disappearing nutrients. And so today we ask, how cheap is cheap food? Please welcome Dan Kittredge, Executive Director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association and Communications Director for the Real Food Campaign.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Good to have you aboard. You've been farming for 30 years, right?
Well, I grew up on a farm.
Yeah, well, there you go.
35 plus, depending on what level of responsibility you're talking about. Yes.
Well, just out of curiosity, I remember growing up on a farm, and it seems like once you reach the age of, I think I sold my first tractor at the age of 6, but when you grow up on a farm, you're a farmer right away, aren't you?
Pretty much, yeah.
somebody's always right there to hand you a chore and say, go do this.
You're doing one thing or another all day long, absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, and you're executive director of the Bio-Nutrient Food Association. What is that?
That is a 10-year-old educational organization. Our principal objective is to increase quality in the food supply. And by quality, we're talking about nutritive value, health-giving attribute, flavor, aroma, those dynamics, mm-hmm. which are oftentimes claimed or assumed by other labels, but for which there's no real empirical assessment.
Well, that's an interesting observation because pretty much true. We always think of food as being food. An apple is an apple. You know, a Hostess ding-dong is a Hostess ding-dong. And we always think that they're full of food, but they're really not sometimes, correct?
Well, I think the point that we're trying to bring forth is that depending on how food is grown, whether it's wheat or apples or carrots or milk, how it's produced, has a major effect on the nutrients within it. I think there's this assumption, you know, that HDPE plastic number 2 is all fairly uniform or whatever. A lot of the you know, gypsum wallboard has certain specific components, and it's, you know, relatively uniform. But with food, it is profoundly varied. People know that with their tongues and with their noses based on flavor because we're actually, you know, we have some very sophisticated nutrient monitoring devices that were inbuilt.
Mm-hmm.
So you can take those experiences of flavor and aroma and you can quantify them in biochemistry with polyphenols and antioxidants and vitamins and elements, et cetera. And so, we've been working since our inception primarily with growers to help them increase the health of their plants, which increases the nutritional value of the food, the nutrient density. It also, in many cases, decreases the cost of production and also builds soil and is beneficial to the environment. And so we started with a real pragmatic approach, grassroots, word of mouth, farmer to farmer, grower to grower. And as we've seen over these many years, that there's some really powerful opportunities here when you begin to effectively work with nature to, you know, produce plants in the way they evolve to grow, then you do have a lot of these other system benefits, which are externalized costs and that sort of cost of food point you're making at the beginning, but they also really correlate with nutritional value and health-giving attribute. And we think that's where the rubber meets the road. You don't talk about cost of food, there's the cost of health or health care, which does not necessarily provide health, and that needs to be factored in because foundationally, we are what we eat, and our functional health and vitality correlates to that to some large degree. So, yeah, we've been working on this project now for the past 3 years to basically bring to consumers the ability to choose which bag of carrots to purchase or which apple to purchase or which milk to purchase based on its nutritional value.
So so that would be the Real Food campaign then, correct?
Yes, that's our broader collaboration.
Okay, so you have the Bionutrient Food Association, which essentially is you working with farmers, saying, look, what we can put food back into the food. And you also are working with the Real Food Campaign, which is a an effort to reach out to those of us who eat food and saying, you can really make a difference with your money by buying the right food. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the eaters of food want to eat it, presumably because it's, you know, good for them and hopefully tastes good. And if we think that if we can help them choose based on those factors and get right through all the labeling and certifications and marketing, then the fact that you spend money on food every day, or most people do, means that we can begin to shift the economic drivers which affect agriculture and therefore our health and therefore the environment's health as well. So we think it's a really powerful opportunity for, you know, the city folk and the country folk to be collaborating along mutual self-interest for the greater good.
I sense that there are those out there who probably don't like this idea. Am I wrong?
I suppose.
You suppose?
I don't
know. Well, I'm thinking about the folks who sell...
What type of entity?
Well, for example, the people sell Hostess Ding Dongs might not be willing to, you know, invest in your effort to alert the consumers as to what they're eating. They might have a problem with that. But at any rate, how do you, in the Real Food Campaign, you have ways of actually measuring the nutrient content or the food value of food, then what's in the food? As you said earlier, consumers tend to look at an apple and say, well, that's an apple. It must be the same as that apple over there. But that is not necessarily so, because the way those apples were grown has a lot to do with what's inside of them. And you have a way of actually measuring the nutrient content. How do you go about doing that?
It's quite a project, actually, but yeah, very fun. Well, our thought is, you know, that the place you want to be at is where someone can, at the grocery store or at the farmer's market, effectively take a picture, flash a light with your smartphone camera, maybe in future generations, but right now would be a, you know, a little piece of hardware, maybe not much bigger than a smartphone, that you would flash a light at a carrot with, and it would basically, by reading the light that bounces back, see what's in that carrot and tell you this is in the 80th percentile for carrots, or this is in the 20th percentile for carrots, etc. That technology is called spectroscopy. It's a very old, you know, decades old technology. We can read what stars, you know, light years away are made up of with spectroscopy. We should be able to read what a carrot in front of us is made up of. Now with the, you know, amazing revolution in handsets and technology, this is plausible. I think people may be familiar with the concept from Star Trek of the tricorder. You know, you just sort of wand this thing in front of something, and it tells you what it is. It reads, it figures out what it is. And so that's basically what we're talking about as the end game. The process involves basically us building a lab, which we've done, running thousands of samples of crops through it, which we've done, identifying the variations in those crops, what's the percent variation in copper from the best carrot to the worst carrot, et cetera, best, you know, antioxidants, best carrot to worst carrot, and then calibrating our little spectrometer with that information. So it's an iterative process. We built the first generation of our spectrometer in 2017. We built a lab in 2018, started running, we did carrots and spinach. We put the meters out there for sale end of 2018 and started shipping them in 2019. In 2019, we added cherry tomatoes and grapes and kale and lettuce. And this year, 2020, we're going to be starting to look at grains and meats and dairies and nuts and seeds and things like that. So it's a process. Basically, you have to identify the variation in the nutrient levels before you can say this is the 20th percentile or the 80th percentile.
So you have to have a base.
What we found, so
you have to have a base level,
yeah,
right?
And that's something that has not apparently been done by anyone. There seems to be no scientific literature anywhere from any country we've been able to find that says this is the spectrum of nutrients that's in carrots, from a really high-quality carrot to a really low-quality carrot. No one's defined those variations. And so we started that work, and we found some pretty significant numbers. From the people know the experience of a tomato off the shelf from the grocery store in January or tomato fresh off the vine in August. You know that experience variation in your mouth. What we found in the crops we've looked at is that between, 300 and 1,800% is the variation in the mineral levels, so copper and zinc and calcium and potassium. That means that, say, this leaf of spinach has four times as much iron in it as that leaf of spinach, or this carrot has 14 times as much copper in it as that carrot, which is quite significant. So, if you're thinking about your eating your fruits and vegetables for their nutritive value, some of them are much, much emptier than others. And then when we looked at the other compounds, the compounds that are sort of more nutritive, antioxidants and polyphenols, you may have heard those terms, we found between 75,000 and 200,000% variation. So it's very large, the variation of nutrients in our food. We know that with our tongues, and we're trying to support people in being able to choose based on that for their families.
Well, I've actually seen this demonstrated by a water witcher, which is to say one of those people who takes a forked stick and can find water underneath the ground. And in a demonstration, I watched as they were given two apples, and one apple was very old and one apple was very fresh. And, from the rest of us looking at the apples, you couldn't tell which was which, but the witcher could. He took his pendulum, and he told us exactly how old each apple was. And you're doing that with a machine.
Right. We're not, expecting that everyone's going to have the subtle senses to be able to tune into such things. And we're trying to use, hardware to machines to study compounds. Yeah.
Okay. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about what's in the food. How cheap is cheap food? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we are back, and this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Dan Kittredge, Executive Director of Bionutrient Food Association, and also a spokesperson for the Real Food Campaign. Dan, what exactly, again, is the Real Food Campaign? How would you define it in like just a few seconds? What would you say about it?
I would say the Real Food Campaign is a collaboration amongst many different entities, organizations, companies, researchers, universities, et cetera, all working to understand what is food quality, what is the variation in food, how to grow it, how to do a better job growing it and how to select it so that we can, you know, basically organize around increasing quality in the food supply.
Okay.
But foundationally, it's a collaborative effort amongst many entities that have this common objective.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would assume that there are a lot of us who eat food who would be interested in this project, simply because there's the potential to have a little device that we could shine a light on something and know how that product compares with the baseline. Is it better than? Is it worse than? That would be very valuable information for all of us who like to eat good food. Now, how far away are we from that?
Well, the first generation tool we have now, which is it's you know, certainly not fancy, but works. We'll have calibrations for the first four crops later this spring. So I'm thinking probably April or May.
Wow.
But the real mass produced slick one that, you know, looks nice and works easily with all kinds of different smartphones, et cetera, probably would be 2 years.
Okay. Coming down the line then. Well,
coming down the pike.
Coming down the pike. Let me back up a little bit and ask you what you think about Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Yeah, well, I think when you factor in its effect on health, as I said earlier, it very much isn't. And when you factor in its effect on the climate and the ecosystem, it certainly isn't. These are externalized costs that are directly related to the caliber of food. And so I would argue it's profoundly less expensive if you factor in the cost of healthcare to eat healthy food. And it's, you know, it's actually systemically beneficial for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, my experience as a farmer, and I got into all this because I grew up on an organic farm. My parents, you know, run an organic farming organization and have since the mid-1980s. And when I set about being a farmer in my own right, providing for my own family that way, I realized that I was going to have a hard time making a living. And, you know, I tracked it down really to the health of my plants. And when I started studying a little more deeply and, you know, modulating practices to effectively work in harmony with life more, my cost of production dropped. And so I would argue that systemically, we have the capacity to produce food that is more nutritious at less of a cost. But it's not going to be through monocultures and chemicals and fertilizers. It's going to be through effectively having nature do more of the work. So, there's a long conversation to be had there. But
okay, real quick, down the line, I'm going to pick this up a little bit more, but you think that's possible with machines, or is it going to require putting more people back on the land?
I don't think it has to be an either or. I think certainly there's a role for machines, and we need not be, you know, entirely without them. But I also think that the quality of life closer to the land is much more compelling than than further away from the land. I'm biased, of course.
Okay.
But yeah, I think you know, a very good life can be had on the land and producing food with thoughtful use of technology. That I think could be a help in a profound revitalization of culture.
Well, amen. I will often think one of the most frightening things about industrialization is that it took people off the land and put them on street corners in the city where they hang around in their hooded sweatshirts and wonder what to do. There's never a problem of what to do when you're on a farm because, as you said, you're always doing something. There's always work to be done. And not so much in the city. But let's go to this USDA study, Department of Agriculture, 2004 study, evaluated data from 43 garden crops from 1950 to 1999. And researchers found statistically reliable declines for six major nutrients, protein, calcium, potassium, iron, vitamins B2 and C, disappearing from the food. Why are these valuable, essential nutrients disappearing?
Because of the way the plants are grown, primarily, to some extent, also because of how they're selected for which varieties, for which purposes.
Let's start with one at a time. Let's start with the soil. What are we doing to the soil to make the nutrients disappear?
We're turning it into dirt. soil is a profoundly sophisticated living ecosystem that plants have evolved with as their gut flora to help them digest the environment and create their bodies. So when you have that system going on, basically the plant makes sugar through photosynthesis in the leaf, right? Out of carbon dioxide and water and sunlight, it makes sugar and oxygen. It emits the oxygen into the atmosphere. We breathe that. And it actually emits the sugar in large part through the roots into the soil to feed bacteria and fungi who then have the capacity to digest the soil to access, copper and zinc and calcium and potassium, et cetera, for the plant.
Sounds like a pretty good deal for all concerned.
That indigenous cultures were able to, manage the landscapes of continents to such a degree that they were absolutely full of food. At all points in time, there was plenty of food around for everybody involved. And they didn't have a wheel, they didn't have a plow, they didn't have beasts of burden. They were thoughtful and, sensitive. And we can do that also. Again, we can maybe have property boundaries. I'm not sure we'll get rid of those anytime soon. But we can thoughtfully work with nature. And in doing so, effectively the plant has access to a much broader spectrum of nutrients when it needs them of the right type than if you use fertilizer. So fertilizer it's functionally soluble nutrients. I liken them to an IV drip. We're supposed to digest our food through our gut flora, the microbes in our gut that digest things for us, in the same way the plants are supposed to digest their food through their gut flora, the microbes in the soil. You can be kept alive on an IV drip, soluble nutrients injected directly into your bloodstream, and that's basically what fertilizer is. And so agriculture is a process of short-circuiting the digestive system of the plants and, sort of getting them onto this IV drip, which is great business for the fertilizer companies, but quite bad for the environment and quite bad for nutrient levels in food and our health. So, it really comes down to how things are grown. And as we've gotten more and more into an industrialized system with agriculture over the past 70 years, we have seen nutrient levels decline.
And what happens then with respect to these soluble fertilizer elements when they hit all those microbuggies in the soil?
So basically what happens first, the insecticides and the herbicides and the fungicides, et cetera, oftentimes they will plant, a corn seed covered in fungicide. And that will specifically kill the microbes in the soil. That's what it's for. They'll spray down an herbicide in the before they plant, and that also will kill the microbes. And so a lot of these things, think of them as like antibiotics. People are coming to realize that if you take antibiotics, they kill your gut flora and they're systemically bad for you. There may be appropriate times for them, but they shouldn't be used as freely as they are. So that's what happens is that you put those chemicals down, they kill the microbes, and then when the fertilizer is put into the soil and the plant basically is sucking that up and it's in the water it sucks up, then it has no reason to feed the microbes, so it doesn't inject those sugars into the soil to begin with.
So do you think the relationship then of losing all of these soil organisms to the nutrient density of food, there's a relationship between those two elements?
Between the soil life?
Yeah, between losing the life in the soil and losing the nutrients in the food. Is there a relationship there?
It's foundational. It's absolutely foundational. Yes.
So if we kill all the organisms in the soil, as we tend to do because they're problematic at times, then we also kind of reduce the nutrient content of our food. Wow.
Well, and we don't ever kill all the microbes. What happens is if you kill all the good ones, some of the bad ones show up. So, you know, you've got staph-resistant infections that are, staph infections that are antibiotic resistant. Mm-hmm. yeah.
And the other,
so you basically set in place some of these unhealthy pathways.
The other element you brought up was the selection, the cultural selection of crops. Sometimes we pick crops for one reason, and it does not tend to be the reason that it contains more nutrient content than another varietal. Red Delicious apples, for example?
Sure. So, you know, as food has become industrialized, it has needed to become more uniform. And so...
Well, wait a minute. Why does it need to be more uniform?
Because that's the way industrialized systems work, through uniformity. They don't work through nuance and complexity.
So if you walk into...
The Model T Fords all look the same because they had the industrial model for manufacturing them.
So when you walk into a grocery store and look at a display of apples, you want all the Red Delicious apples to look exactly alike, correct? And if one looks a little bit different, then you're not going to buy it.
I guess that's what city people do.
Well, that's pretty much what city people do, because if you look at a display of Red Delicious apples, they all
look
exactly...
That's all they have access to.
Yeah,
they have access to. Let's go to the farmer's market. Maybe if you go to the farmer's market, you get better selection.
There you go.
Now, the whole model, the model's been designed to facilitate this industrial system, which is good for certain large entities, but bad for any number of others.
Right. Now, there's another element that I see popping up, and I'm not sure about the veracity of it or not, but some say that the increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the air is having an impact on nutrient content as well. Do you have any figures on that?
There was one paper or article that came out a couple of years ago that made that argument, and it did have a couple of logical leaps that I don't think were correct. As part of it. Actually, carbon dioxide is very beneficial for plants.
Well, that's what they breathe.
As I said, it's that's right. What... And so, as an example, a friend of mine is an agronomist and works with a lot of, large growers in the Midwest and around the country. And they've got these little CO2 sensors that they stick in the soil. And so in the middle of the cornfield in July, you'll see the CO2 levels spike and collapse through the day. What happens when the sun is shining is that corn leaves are sucking all the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and you can get the CO2 down to 50 parts per million or 100 parts per million, a quarter or an eighth of what it is in the ambient atmosphere, and it'll actually become a limiting factor in plant growth, and that happens right now. And then as this, sun sets, and the plant begins to inject all these sugars down into the soil, and the microbes eat them, and they breathe oxygen, and so they breathe out carbon dioxide. There begins to be this carbon dioxide that comes up from the soil into the leaf zone. And so it might be 10,000 parts per million at 6 a.m. and 50 parts per million at 3 p.m. So there's this profound cycling of carbon dioxide that goes on, and the numbers in a field are... the variance is quite large.
It seems like
I don't think that CO2 increases is going to make plants less nutritious. I don't agree with that argument.
Okay, good. It seems like when you take a quick look at the food chain, what you see is everything is all of life is happily eating all of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps
going. It's a beautiful ecosystem.
It's a beautiful ecosystem. If we can only learn to look at it and live with it, which is the question of the day.
Yeah.
How do we interact with this environment so that we can grow food that holds and has all of these wonderful nutrients that sustain us? Because if you look at the history of our food, what you see is that it's becoming less and less food-like. The form is still there, but the content is disappearing. So what is happening with our food? That is the question that we have on the table today with Food Chain Radio Program with Dan Kittredge, who is the Executive Director of the Bionutrient Food Association and the Communications Director for the Real Food Campaign. And when we come back, I'd like to ask Dan what happens when we humans eat food that no longer contains any nutrients, or the nutrients are gone. What happens to us? What happens? We quit eating real food. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, and we will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, if you look at the studies, what you'll see
is... You've been listening to the...
Just settle down there. If you look at the studies, what you will see is that over time, our food has become less and less nutritious. USDA even looked at it, and from a study between 1950, 1999, half century, researchers found statistically reliable declines in six major nutrients disappearing, statistically significant. What they say is that if you used to get by with five servings of broccoli, now you need six. So we have to eat more and more and more to keep the same amount of food. Not fair, right? So what can we do? Grow more nutritious food. At least that's what Dan Kittredge is suggesting. Dan, what happens when we eat food without food in it?
Well, we start to fall apart.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I like to use the example of a car. And, you know, if you're driving a car and the brake pads wear out, they're designed to be taken out and new brake pads put in. If your muffler rusts out, it's designed to be taken out and a new muffler put in. That's a mechanical system. And it's designed to, you know, have interchangeable parts that can be replaced. We are not mechanical systems. We are biological systems. We are not designed to have our knees taken out and our livers taken out and replaced, et cetera. Certainly it can be done. But the way we're designed to function is that every day our body takes our oldest, junkiest cells from the liver and the eyeballs and the flesh and the blood and the bones. It disassembles them. It, you know, salvages what parts can be used and then dumps the rest out the rear end. And it builds new cells in their place based on or out of what you've eaten. And there's a whole broad spectrum of elements and nutrients that you need to build your body properly. What happens when you don't have the nutrients in your food is that you don't build your body properly. And so the new cells that got built, you know, weren't functioning at top level, even when they, at the beginning of their lifespan. So, you know, there's, I think, you know, over 2 dozen specific elements, for instance, that are required in the replication of one strand of DNA. Copper, zinc, calcium, potassium, phosphorus, sulfur, molybdenum, cobalt, selenium, chromium. You know, how many elements can you name, and how many elements are farmers managing for when they're, you know, doing their fertilizer? Usually they're managing for three or four, maybe five elements.
NPK.
Our bodies need dozens. Right. And so as we, you know, build up these deficits of critical ingredients in our body, we begin to break down. And so the epidemic levels of chronic illness, you know, physical, psychological, emotional, I would argue even spiritual, that are sort of building in our culture, we argue, to a large degree, have at their root cause a lack of the nutrition we need to build our bodies with.
Well, I would
you know,
argue...
We get about 4 billion new cells every day. And if you do the math on how many cells are in your body that are human... you know, you get a new body every 6 months or so. Your blood takes 2 weeks to replace itself. Your bones may take 7 years. But if you average it out, you get a new body every 6 months. And so depending on what was in what you ate, your body is to a large degree, that functional.
So if we're not getting the food we're eating, we're continually in a state of decomposition because we're getting less and less and less as we go along. Now, it seems to me like there's another element here. When we eat food that's deficient in essential nutrients, we're still hungry. What do we do then?
Yeah.
We start cribbing on things that we shouldn't be cribbing on, which is like Hostess Ding Dongs or who knows what. And we start eating food that is empty of essential nutrients but probably has lots of sugars in it. And so we start blowing ourselves up and become obese.
I like to make a strong distinction between junk and food. I would argue that it's either junk or it's food, but it can't be both. So let's just, call a spade here. Those things that have that effect on you are not food. Let's stop calling them that.
Food, yeah, maybe if you were kind, you could call them food-like substances or what have you.
I think we should just call them junk. Get rid of the food half of the word and call it junk.
Yeah, and I would also argue that with respect to the spiritual element of starving oneself, I would suspect that's a huge element in the loss of spirituality, is losing one's ability to think clearly. I once did a radio show with a criminologist who studied some prisoners and had a, because the thing about studying prisoners is that you can control the experiment, right? You can feed these prisoners this and those prisoners that. So he took the control group, just ate regular prison food, but the group that he wanted to look at, he gave them a plain old multivitamin. And over the course of time, he measured their criminal behavior. And whereas the control group that ate regular prison food showed no decline in the amount of criminal behavior, those that had the multivitamin demonstrated a significant, I think it was something like a 78% less criminal behavior. So I think that's a huge difference in what nutrition can do for the human mind.
Our spirit, I mean, we can get down to the physics and the metaphysics or the, the quantum physics about it, but I think there's a strong argument to be made there. And, a lot of our psychological and emotional habits are actually directed by our gut flora, the microbes that live within us. They, have a lot of effect by the compounds they make on the impulses that we act on. Mm-hmm. And the health of the gut is foundationally determined by the quality of the food you eat.
From what I understand,
absolutely,
much of one's immune system is generated in the gut. And those little tiny microbuggies in the gut are what give us a defense against diseases and whatnot as well. So,
let me say something. I will say one thing about the microbes. This is a really important point, that we need to understand that we are not an organism, an animal. We are an ecosystem.
Yeah, we're like the Amazon jungle.
Ecosystem.
We're like
And we need to understand when we eat our food that we need to not just feed our animal, but we need to feed the ecosystem. And so I'll just give you an example of juicing. If you take a carrot and a celery and, kale, and you take all the substance out and you just take the juice, those nutrients in the juice might be able to be accessed by your body, but the substance is what the microbes need to eat. And so when you don't have that substance from real food, from whole grains, from fruits and vegetables in your gut, your microbes can't reproduce, at least the healthy ones can't. And so it's really incumbent on us to understand that, we are not going to get solutions to this systemically from supplements, from juices, from pills, et cetera. We are evolved to eat real food, and we need to have that be a significant part of our diet to really get to the next level.
I sometimes say that as you said, we're not just an organism. We're more like the Amazon jungle walking down the street. We have all kinds of critters that we have to support. And it's hard for us to imagine that because when we look in the mirror, we see ourselves. But what we're really looking at is a whole ecosystem, as you call it, as probably as complex as the Amazon jungle. It gets right down to it.
Trillions of different organisms. Trillions of different organisms.
So,
we are in a profoundly symbiotic ecosystem. Yeah.
So, Dan Kittredge, your intent on bringing this notion of whole foods and nutrient-rich whole foods to the general public and have a device by which people can actually see what's in food. So there was a question on the radio the other day from one of our hosts, and they were talking about dark matter, and they suggested, how can you go about studying dark matter? And so I just suggested maybe you could just shine a light on it, and if it's really matter, you'll see it, and if it's not, it'll just be dark. And that's kind of where we're at here.
Yeah, somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
So you're looking at actually showing people, but that's kind of frightening to certain sectors of the food chain, of people who provide us food, too, because they figured out how to make food cheap by industrializing it, by taking the nutrients out of it. And so what's going to happen if Dan Kittredge comes along with a widget that shows people what's inside that food?
Well, hopefully there'll be a bit of a transition in how things are done. It'll be a disruptor. Cell phones were disrupted, landlines, and computers disrupted phone line, whatever. The mail system. There's no reason you can't still have large farms doing a hell of a lot of a better job, right? It's not like everything's going to turn on a dime and we're all going to go back to this agrarian, history, somewhat updated, that not everyone necessarily is interested in. We can still have large farms. We can still use tractors. You can still use combines. But if we understand how to work more in harmony with nature, we will, sequester carbon. We will heal the environment. We will decrease the cost of production for farmers, increase their economic viability, and we'll increase nutrient levels for people, and we'll decrease chronic illness. Mm-hmm. So we think that there's an opportunity here for us to coalesce around a solution that's not doom and gloom, fear, us and them, but say, let's all of us together understand that we have power in the money that we buy food with to really positively impact our health, our family's health, our culture's health, and our environment's health.
Now that you brought it up, money, because what I see developing here is a very interesting conflict between money, because those who have industrialized agriculture have learned how to use the economies of their scale to influence how decisions are made. And one of the examples I like to use is how small farmers once got together and decided that we wanted to protect their name organic. And so they took that name and gave it to the government for safekeeping. But that government is very vulnerable to those who have the economies of scale sufficient to influence the government. And as a consequence, what happened to the word organic? Well, goodness, you can grow organic food in water now and put an organic label on it. So it seems to me like for this really to work, the conflict between the contest between money has to be between those who have the economies of scale sufficient to influence and control the government, and those who can get to the consumer and get the consumer to make the right buy. Do you think you can win that one?
Absolutely. Yeah. I would sort of disagree with your characterization of how it went with organic. That's a separate conversation.
Okay.
The central point was, how do we leverage money to accomplish symbiotic ends? And companies, to a large degree, will only keep producing that which consumers will buy. And so as we have consumers able to see for themselves what the better stuff is and what the worse stuff is, my hope, expectation, is that the worst stuff will start sitting on the shelves. And if we can give companies that are in the middle of the supply chain, the buyers and the packers and the wholesalers and the retailers, the ability to check the quality because they know that the good stuff's going to sell and the bad stuff isn't, then that will be a feedback loop that goes to the farmers. And the farmers that are producing the high quality stuff will know their stuff is sold, and the ones that are not will know that it's less likely to be. And there'll be an incentive for the farmers to change their practices. And we're doing this whole project all the way with a thought to all of that. The last thing we want is farmers to be told, look, your stuff is no good. We don't want to buy it. So that's where our foundation is figuring all that out so we can help farmers change practices. So, you've got major supply chain operators, ADM and Cargill, that are, shipping around tens of millions of tons of grain every year. They're going to keep doing that. That's fine. Monsanto sells fertilizer. Fine. Let them sell things that can be used to help build soil.
Amen.
Out of time, Dan.
But really quickly, how do we get in touch with the Real Food Campaign?
Realfoodcampaign.org.
There you go, Dan Kittredge.
And our
Dan
organization is Bionutrient.
And Bionutrient
as well.
Thank you so much, Dan. Really appreciate your participation today. All right, folks, that was the Food Chain. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.